I'm Diana Jeter. I work at the University of Liverpool. I'm Associate Dean for Education in the School of Histories, Languages and Cultures. And we have been on strike now since sometime in May. We're the longest running strike in Merseyside since the Dockers, and we're absolutely solid. And the reason why we're striking is because there is an attempt to sack some of our colleagues in health and life sciences with either compulsory or voluntary redundancy, but not because the roles need to be removed because there is a financial problem. And as I'm sure you know, employment law says that you can make people redundant if there's a business case to do so. But what you're making redundant are the roles, not the people. But in this case, what they're doing is they're actually sacking people, and they're doing so on the grounds that they have failed against performance criteria that they had never actually been asked to meet in the first place. So we are fighting this on the principle that if we lose, then it has been conceded that bosses have the right to sack anybody on a whim whenever they want to.
I mean, surely the university will say, well, if these people aren't performing, we don't really want them here anymore.
Except that the criteria against which they say they're not performing would actually apply to about 80% of the university.
So how does this scoring work? How do they decide, you know, such and such is a brilliant teacher and somebody else is not doing the job?
Oh, well, all of these people, as far as we can tell, are brilliant teachers. They've also often brought in large sums of money for projects, but there are two main criteria that are being used. The first is citation criteria. In other words, is their published work being cited? And the system against which those citations are measured is a system called DORA. I can't remember exactly what DORA stands for. It's an international citation measurement. As a metric, it was never intended to measure individual performance. And DORA have stated numerous times during this dispute that their metric was never intended as a measure of individual performance. You can use this metric to look at the work of people like Stephen Hawking, as I say, about 80% of the university, most Nobel Prize winners, and depending on which time period you chose to measure against, they would fail against that metric. So that's the first one. Dodgy use of metrics there. The other criteria that they're using is not bringing in enough research income. This is despite the fact that one of the people whose job was at risk had brought in millions of pounds for health, community health in Liverpool, but it had been money for a community health project and it wasn't money going into the department. So they're being told they hadn't brought in enough money, research money, into the department. Now, some of these people do very local health work that doesn't require huge sums of money. So to use the amount that they brought in as a metric is meaningless as a measure of their performance in any case. But the key issue is that none of them had ever been told that this was a metric that they had to meet. So they weren't attempting to bring in a certain level of research funding because nobody had told them that they had to.
I mean, it does sound to me like the way universities operate are changing enormously. Is this partly due to the fact that universities are being told by central government they've got to bring in lots of their money from private income, from private sources?
Well, that is going on. There is clearly a marketization and privatization of higher education going on. That isn't specifically what's happening in this case. In this case, as far as we can tell, although freedom of information requests for the business case for these redundancies have not produced any minutes of a meeting where the business case has been put. So we don't know what the business case is here or why they're claiming it. But as far as we can tell, what happened was that the head of our health and life sciences faculty wanted to get rid of a bunch of people in order to bring in a bunch of other people that would be suitable for her to then be able to put in a bid for a big research centre which would be very high status for her personally. And there's no local demand for this big research centre. And indeed, when she tried to make that case that if they got this research funding for this new cancer research centre, that it would be good for health inequalities in Liverpool, all of the local MPs wrote and replied saying, this is not our priority, and we think that making 47 members of staff redundant is going to do more damage in terms of pressure on the mental health services than whatever your shiny new planned centre might be intended to achieve. So it seems that what is happening here is basically a vanity project, which couldn't be achieved unless new people were brought in. And the only way that, so what should have been done is the funding should have been sought elsewhere to do that. But instead, they tried to do what they called creating financial headroom by getting rid of some immensely valuable colleagues. And so it's not in this case a sort of directive from government. It's personal ambition of the head of health and life sciences. However, what we are seeing is that right across the UK, other vice chancellors and senior leadership teams are looking at what's happening in Liverpool and are trying to make similar cuts to their workforce and changes to their workforce, and have seen what's happened here and have realised that they can't do it. They can't go ahead with redundancies without a proper business case. And the reason why so many of them are trying to do that is, of course, because of the wider context in which higher education's being turned into a market sector rather than an education sector.
Well, that doesn't sound very good. I would imagine that, you know, you got into teaching because you're interested in education. I mean, surely this, you know, it's not really appropriate to have a marketplace in education. Surely, you know, people should be being taught to do stuff either just purely for the, you know, beauty of the knowledge of it, or else, you know, for a specific job path of some kind. So I'm just interested in, you know, what's your take on this change that there's been over pure academia, which is now seems to be being replaced by people being just prepared for specific jobs.
Yes, as you're right, this is overtly government policy, as we've seen with the increased funding for STEM at the expense of social sciences and humanities, which are more designed to develop critical thinking. And they're quite open about that. And one can understand that at one level, as a country, we do need more people with STEM type skills. We also need more plumbers and carpenters and, you know, all that kind of thing as well. But the government is doing some things right in that it's recognizing that we need to change the skill sets. What it's doing wrong is trying to continue with a massively outmoded British way of doing these things, which is to only give status to university degrees and not follow the kind of route that Germany has been following for decades, which is that you value all kinds of training and you fund it properly. So what they're trying to do is training on the cheap, shunting school kids into manual training and apprenticeships that aren't properly funded, and then also suggesting to them that they've in some way failed, while as the kids that get to the Russell Group universities have been told that they have in some way succeeded, and yet they are not then, unless they're following in STEM subjects, they're not really being encouraged to develop the kinds of critical thinking skills that the country needs. So that the value of creativity, the value of critical thinking, the value of the humanities is simply not recognised by the government. Therefore, if students want to study those subjects, well, that's fine, but they're paying for it. That's their personal choice. It's not something that the government wants to support. So they're cutting the additional top-up money that they used to put into those subjects, and instead they're putting it in the STEM subjects. Of course, it's not fair on the way that they're representing the STEM students either, because they're representing the STEM students as if they are purely instrumentalist, whereas, of course, many of the STEM students are driven by a wonder of the natural world and a thirst for knowledge and a desire for critical thinking as well.
But what about the strike? Surely, you know, this is not really, you're not actually by striking affecting the people you really want to affect. You're affecting the students and their ability to learn, not the the key people in the university making these big decisions.
Oh, well, what has happened is that we first of all had an all-out strike. Then we moved to action short of a strike, work to rule, with a marking and assessment boycott. Now, the university thought this was playing into their hands because we would appear to be abandoning the students at the moment that it counted. But of course, we've been working with these students all year. The students know and trust us, and we explained to them what was going on. One of our students, student who I actually taught in his second year, spoke at one of our rallies, and the students themselves have been organising rallies in support of us. This was actually a union organised rally rather than a student organised rally, but the students always turn out to speak at the union rallies too. And one of my students said, and it actually brought a lump to my throat, he said, and he was addressing the staff who were on strike, and he said, you've had our back all through this year with COVID and made sure that we were okay during the challenges we've faced this year. You had our backs and now we've got yours. And that's how the students have been. They're totally supporting us. The university, meanwhile, has been trying to say nothing to see here. Results are about to come out. Only a tiny number of people on strike. No big deal. Nothing to worry about. And have gradually got themselves into a deeper and deeper hole, because of course the marks aren't coming out until we get settlement, and so we have shown the university to be lying and downplaying the impact that the strike is having at every turn, and the students have been backing us up. So on the whole, we've got massive solidarity between staff and students, and the students of course are learning a lot from this about how to run a dispute, how to negotiate, how to strategize, how to organize, how to run public meetings. And it's been a fantastic learning opportunity for the students as well to be part of this action with us. And on the whole, the students don't feel that they are being damaged, because they understand that this is a dispute about employers not being able to sack people on a whim, and that you cannot make people redundant without good reason. And the students know that if we lose this struggle, then that's going to affect them in any future jobs they go into as well.
If you lose, it would also presumably affect, it would have a kind of domino effect with other universities doing similar things. What do you think, if you do lose, how do you think that the way that universities are run might change around the country? It's quite an important little dispute, this, isn't it?
Yes, and we're not going to lose. It was originally 47 jobs that were at risk. It's now down to 2. And the management obviously thought when it was only 2, we'd say, oh, all right, then let's settle. But because it's a matter of principle, we've been absolutely clear, 0 compulsory redundancies. So we're still holding out. Now, the reason why we've been able to hold out is because of the massive support that we've had from the trade union movement. We have a huge fighting fund, and we know that we can go on with this for as long as it takes. Making sure that our strategies don't harm students too much, but hit our management hard. And we will go on fighting for as long as it takes, because we can, because we have the support of the trade union movement. When we began, we only had £6,000 in our fighting fund, and we were all very scared. When we decided we were going to go, after our 3 weeks of strike, that we were going to continue with marking and assessment boycott, and the university said to us, if you don't do the marking, which is only a small part of our role, but they said, if you don't do the marking, we're not going to pay you anything. We're going to deduct 100%. And we were all very scared. We had £6,000 in our strike fund. We all looked at each other. This was online. We swallowed hard and we said, go for it. And then what happened was the trade union movement said, we'll support you. So our fear that we would all become destitute just evaporated. We know that we're going to be all right. Meanwhile, we have heard that other universities' senior management to senior leadership teams have been saying in negotiations with unions about proposed redundancies elsewhere, they don't want to do a Liverpool. So we're already having an impact.
Okay. Where's the best place for listeners to follow what's going on, Diana?
There is a website, which, of course, I've got on my phone and I'm speaking to you on my phone. It's HLS47 and then I think it's .org.
So what does the HLS47 mean?
The HLS is Health and Life Sciences. That's the faculty. And 47 was the number of jobs at risk.
OK, Diana Jeter, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for finding out about the struggle. And any donations to our strike fund will still be welcome because it's not over yet.